We're going to be studying tonight a tshuva, sort of a tshuva, by Rabbi Leo Kalatskin. Leo Kalatskin was a great gaon in his time, end of the 19th century, early 20th century, through World War I, virtually unknown today. I certainly had never heard of him until I came across some of his work when I was learning halacha. But in his time, apparently, he was one of the leading Gedolei Hara of Poland and Russia. Quite an interesting character. He was something of a child prodigy, apparently. He was showed great promise as a child. Grew up, got married. He, according to Wikipedia biography anyway, he followed his wife and her family to St. Petersburg, where he was very excited. They told him that the big library there had Jewish books, so he apparently went and taught. He had had a typical Haredi Polish education, but he apparently taught himself several languages, Russian, Latin, German, and spent a lot of time in the library. Unfortunately, while he was there, his wife's family, including his wife, left religion. The marriage broke up. He left his kids behind with her. Got married a couple other times throughout his life. But he was, as we'll see in this tshuva, he was quite an interesting fellow as an autodidact. Never a maskil. Never had any, as far as I know, never had any real sympathy with modernity. But he was programmatically, philosophically. But he was well read. Apparently read and may have understood several languages. His tshuvas are full of these interesting little tidbits from the news, as we'll see here, from developments in science and culture. But he was very much embedded within the Haredi world. I mentioned earlier there's a letter from Rav Simcha Zelig of Brisk, the Dayan of Brisk, who needed help on an Aguna Shaila once. He wrote to Rav Kalatskin asking him for help. He says, you know, I know Rav Chaim lives here, but Rav Chaim doesn't get involved. Everyone knows doesn't get involved in Hara, so you know you're my second choice. Help me out with this Aguna question. Now Rav Kalatskin, actually, some of his rulings that have come down to us in this age, his most famous or most controversial, are actually on the subject of Aguna. After World War I, he was very active in attempting to free Agunas of men who had disappeared during the war. And he had some radically innovative rulings, so radical to the extent that if they were proposed by someone of lesser stature, we'd probably hold them up as an example of making a mockery of the halakhic process. As it is, they were extremely novel ideas. And he actually has the idea that in certain cases you can actually write a get without authorization by the husband if you assume he'd be okay with it. He was talking about men who had disappeared, soldiers, or people who had gone missing after the war. He said, let Basin just write a get. You know, if he's dead, he's dead. If he's alive, surely he wants to give a get. He should want to give a get. He has no right to abandon his wife forever. Probably he's just stuck somewhere. He wants to give a get. He actually was willing to allow, at least tentatively, the Basin to write a get on behalf of the husband. This is obviously a very novel and rather controversial thing to say. Rabbi Yisrael Mintzberg, a friend and colleague of his in Israel, vehemently wrote rejecting this, saying, I wouldn't care if this was some minor shul rabbi. He says, but this is Leo Kalatskin, who has so much authority and so much influence that if he says things like this and they don't go unchallenged, that people might actually listen to them. He actually claims that Rav Kalatskin retracted and told him to issue a retraction, although for some reason he never bothered to pen one by himself in his own name. This ruling over Leo Kalatskin was actually in the news recently again. A few years ago, there was the great controversy of the Get of Tzfas, where there was a fellow young man got into a motorcycle accident, was in a persistent vegetative state for years, apparently no hope of recovery, according to the doctors. So a Beis Din in Tzfas allowed itself the prerogative of writing a get on its own for the husband and giving it to the woman without any involvement of the husband himself. This was obviously created a huge controversy. Many people were vehemently opposed to what they had done. Rabbi Bleich wrote something like a 90-page tour de force, tearing them to bits for this. But one of the central issues, one of the main precedents for doing such a thing, was this ruling over Leo Kalatskin, who argued that in principle, in certain cases, Beis Din could issue a get if there's no reason not to, if they believe it's in the best interest of the husband, etc., that you can write such a get. So everyone, they spent a lot of time saying, no, we don't paskin like that. So Mintzberg said that he retracted and so on. But he's famous for that precedent. In any event, he was one of these great gaonim of the time who perhaps didn't have the luck of writing or saying things that would be famous or go down in history. So he's virtually unknown today, but in his time, he was one of the one of the great gedolim of Harai, Jewish learning in general in Poland and Russia. So he has a bunch of svarim, kind of miscellaneous collections of his work. They're not all tshuvas in the classic sense. Imre Sheffer, he describes as tshuvas with other things, other chidushim in them. The one we're doing today is not actually a tshuva in the sense of being written to a specific person about a specific case. It was more a general essay he wrote on the topic of Tzar Bala Chaim. It's a very long tshuva. This is, in our series here, this is the first tshuva that I have not excerpted the whole thing. This is a very short excerpt of the tshuva. The tshuva is about 16 pages. I pulled out here about a page or two of some of the particularly interesting sections. He has a long essay, essentially, on Tzar Bala Chaim, in which he takes a notably strict view. Just to go through some of the background to understand more about what his position is, the Talmud in various places talks about Tzar Bala Chaim. The Talmud brings a dispute as to whether Tzar Bala Chaim is Daraisa or Drabanan. Not even clear. We paskin, many poskin paskin Tzar Bala Chaim Daraisa. There are different sources that they find in the biblical text itself for Tzar Bala Chaim. Famously, Shiluach HaKein, send away the mother bird. Some Rishonim, Rambam, Ramban, seem to root in Tzar Bala Chaim, despite the Mishnah that says if you say that, we're Meshatkin also, that you can't say that. Nevertheless, the Rambam and the Ramban both say it is an issue of Tzar Bala Chaim. Osev Espino, not killing mother and child animals on the same day. And so on. Pre-Kantina, helping somebody unload an animal if the animal is staggering under a too heavy load. Gemara relates that to Tzar Bala Chaim. So the Gemara has, and there are a handful of Gemaras throughout Shas that talk about the prohibition of Tzar Bala Chaim. Everyone agrees that it is prohibited to inflict pain on an animal for no reason, but that's the key question. Everyone also agrees that we do things to animals that are unpleasant. We kill them. Some say Tzar Bala Chaim only applies to hurting them while they're alive, not to killing them, but we certainly do things. We make the animals work. We make them plow fields, and we load them up in the first place, Truman Sedation points out. Even though sometimes it gets too heavy, we do make them bear burdens and so on. We clearly do things that the animals might prefer that we don't do to them. So the question is, what is usser and what is mutter? So the Gemara never gives any kind of systematic explanation for what's usser, what's mutter. And even really the Shulchan Aruch, there isn't really any comprehensive, systematic discussion of what's mutter, what's usser. The primary early source cited on the topic is a response of the Truman Sedation. He was asked about doing things that cause pain to animals, pulling out their feathers to use for quills or for other purposes, or doing other things to animals or other types of living creatures that might hurt them. And he asks, is that mutter or is that a problem of Tzar Bala Chaim? So he answers, on the one hand, he says, in principle, there is no issue of Tzar Bala Chaim, Iker Adin, there's no issue of Tzar Bala Chaim, because he establishes a rule that Kol Tzarech Adam, Ein Bo Mishum Tzar Bala Chaim, anything which involves human benefit, which is being done for the welfare or profit of humans, does not violate the prohibition of Tzar Bala Chaim. However, after establishing this to his satisfaction from various Talmudic sources, he does a kind of about-face in the end of the tshuva and says, even so, if certain actions are particularly cruel toward animals, ha'olam nimnoim mizeh, people are meticulous to avoid doing it because they consider it achzarius, they consider it cruelty. And as a source for this, he brings an Agadata Gemara. The Gemara says, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, the compiler of the Mishnah, had great suffering for a period of years, horrific, unspeakable physical malady of some sort, ailments of some sort, that he was crying out in pain. It was just in abject agony for years. So the Gemara explains what happened. What triggered, spiritually speaking, what triggered the onset of his illness and what eventually released him from it. So the Gemara gives a couple of bookends, a couple of episodes that occurred. To begin with, it says there was once a calf that was being literally taken to the slaughter. And the calf realized its fate, so it ran to Revi and it buried its head in his lap and asked him for protection, for security. So Revi said, go, lekach letzarta. This is what you're created for. This is your destiny. This is what you're here for. And he basically turned the cold shoulder to the cow. So the heavenly voice said, he doesn't care about the suffering of other living creatures. Or we will not care what happens to him. And he had these unspeakable unspeakable pain for years. Years later, it says he was once there when his maidservant was cleaning. She was sweeping, and she found a nest of some kind of litter of some kind of rodents, weasels, some kind of little animals. She was going to toss them all out. And he said, Rebbe told her, let them go, you leave them alone. It says, V'rachma v'kal ma'aseh en ashrei, V'rachma v'kal ma'aseh, his compassion extends to all his works, so let leave them be. Ah, so in Shemayim they said, he cares about the suffering of others, we're going to care about his suffering, so they released him from his agony. So Truma Sedeshin says, not strictly halacha, la halacha you're allowed to shech gavs, and la halacha you're allowed to sweep out the mice from the house. However, there still is an Indian, it's still praiseworthy to refrain from Akhtarius. I guess Rabbi Danasi was on a lofty level, and he was punished severely for not practicing this level of bite. This Truma Sedeshin, along with one or two other similar sources, are codified by the Ramban, Shulchan Aruch. He says that really the general rule is anything which is for human benefit, human necessity, we'll discuss more precisely those terms soon, but anything which is for a good human reason is okay. Nevertheless, people are, it's good to be more careful than that. It's good to be go beyond that because it's to avoid achzaris. They showed me that the Prima Gadim, Hilchos Pesach, brings a custom. People used to, I'm not sure what the right word for this is, but used to somehow cripple their birds. They used to have pet birds from gardens, and they didn't want them to fly away, so they somehow maimed or deformed the wings of the birds, so they couldn't fly. Prima Gadim says you can't do that because that is Tzar Balei Chaim. Even though I have some reason, I like the birds in my garden, they're pretty, they sing nicely, whatever it is, nevertheless, to damage their wings, their bones, in such a way that they can't fly, that's Tzar Balei Chaim. As we'll see later in Rav Galatskin and other sources, the general attitude of poskim often is, on the one hand, yes, in principle, we accept the rule, the basic rule, that anything which is done for human need, for human benefit, doesn't have Tzar Balei Chaim, but in practice, we have to weigh, on the one hand, the benefit to humans against the level of pain to the animals, and at some point, even if it's mutter mikra din, it's not appropriate. This is also really what the well-known Shuva, the Noda Behuda, says. He was asked about recreational hunting. He describes a Jew, a rich aristocratic Jew, who had forests and villages and so on. He wanted to go take the fire stick, the Knei Asreifa, and go shoot animals, which is what the aristocrats did in his time. Is it okay? The Noda Behuda says that al pi halacha, it's mutter, and Tzar Balei Chaim doesn't apply because if you get some enjoyment, if there's some if something constructive you get out of hunting, certainly if you're hunting for a business, you have you can eat the animals or you can't eat them if you kill them, but you're going to take the hides or sell them. That's certainly okay, even for recreation. Mikra din it's mutter if you enjoy it. However, he says it's not appropriate. Jews are rachmanim. The two biblical hunters, and we're reading about in the Parshiyos now, are Esav and Nimrod. Not the company you want to be in. So again, the idea is that Tzar Balei Chaim is technically mutter if there's some human benefit. It doesn't even have to be so much a major benefit. But still, achzarius is not appropriate for a Jew. Rav Adi Yosef has a tshuva about bullfighting. He's not even talking about participating in bullfighting. He's talking about Jews attending as spectators. Not appropriate, he says, Tzar Balei Chaim. This is not what Jews do. He seems to imply, if I recall correctly, it's Asur Mikra Din to just hurt the animals and goad them and torture them like that. He doesn't consider the enjoyment of a bullfight to be a legitimate reason to avoid Tzar Balei Chaim. But in general, this is the backdrop. This is what the later posts came all right against the backdrop of this Truma Sedeshin. On the one hand, as long as there's a human need, a human reason for it, it is okay. On the other hand, if there's no human need, it's Tzar Balei Chaim. And even if there is a human need, there still is a concern for achzarius, for cruelty. Now, Rav Galatskin's tshuva is primarily about what is defined, how do we define human need? What does need mean? How much do you have to actually need it? He's trying to argue that the Rama, when he brings it to Truma Sedeshin, he doesn't mean any whim, any benefit or tickle of pleasure you have from doing this. Need means a genuine need. And even for money, even if it's a question of it's economically beneficial for you, you stand to make more money by doing something, even that is not considered a sufficient need. The Rama uses language refuah. Anything done for refuah, to heal people, is okay. But not necessarily just questions like make more money. So he begins by discussing a machlokas a century or so earlier between Rav Yaakov Edlinger, the Binyan Sion, and the Wurzburger Rav, the Yad Halevi, Rabbi Bamberger, I think. about, the question was, they had a bechar of an animal, firstborn animal, which we know has Kedushas bechar. And with Manazeh, you can't check that. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash. You can't really do anything with it. Usually we try to avoid Bechar by selling the mother or selling the Bechar in utero before it's born. But if something goes wrong and you have a Bechar, it's a real problem. You can't work it. You have to take care of it. You can't kill it. You have to just let it go and raise it. And it's difficult. So normally, the one thing that releases it from the Chumra of Bechar is a Mum. Different types of blemishes that qualify as a Mum. Now, you're not allowed to actually inflict a Mum generally. That's an Isser and being Matal Mum B'Bechar. However, in certain cases, whether it's a Safek and other mitigating circumstances, the question comes up in the Poskim whether you would be allowed to just avoid the Shaila by making a Mum. So earlier, Acharim had already said it's not so simple because Mum is painful. Most Mumim are going to be painful to the animals. Maybe that's Tzar Bali Chaim. So this debate between the Binyan Tzion and the Wurzburger Rav, they were debating whether, but it's beneficial. It's easier for me financially. It's easier not to have to raise this animal, this unproductive animal. It significantly makes my life much easier and makes my business more profitable to do this. Is that considered a tzarech of an adam that allows me to just slash the animal's ear or something to make a mum which will hurt and injure the animal? The Poskim argued about that, whether that's considered enough of a tzarech adam to allow hurting and injuring an animal. And the point of much of the Imre Shefer's tshuva is to argue that there's no clear source in Shas that for mere financial gain that would be considered enough of a reason to injure an animal. And he's basically arguing at length for a much stricter stance towards Tzar Bali Chaim than some other poskim have taken, that you need a real benefit like refuah, some genuine human need, not just to fatten your balance sheet. So in the course of his tshuva, he gets into a very interesting discussion, and that's the part I have excerpted here, about medical experimentation on animals. Animal subject testing to learn about anatomy, to test actual medicines, test surgical techniques, and so on. So, as he acknowledges, he's not the first one to raise this question. A version of this question had come up a century earlier, back already in the 18th century, I think, of the Shvus Yaakov, Rav Yaakov Reischer. He was asked about testing poisons on animals, testing, feeding them with... feeding animals with poisons in order to understand how the poisons work and to derive countermeasures to them and antidotes and so on. So this is basically an early form of animal testing for human medical knowledge. So the Shvus Yaakov, which he brings here in the third paragraph, was asked by a doctor, can I do this? Can I feed the animal noxious substances in order to learn about how they work and to learn how to counteract them? And he said it's pashut that it's mutter. Shvus Yaakov said pashut that it's mutter. And he brought the Ramah in Ebn Ezra, which brings that Truma Tadesh, and that anything done for a fool of a person is okay. Well, even though the Ramah did say that even if it's okay, but if it causes the animal serious pain, it's achdarius, Truma Tadesh said he really shouldn't do it. So the Shvus Yaakov says, does that mean this doctor also, it's mutter, but I should tell him that it's achdarius and you really shouldn't do it if you want to do the right thing? He says, no, this is not as bad. The poison is, he gets into very legalistic arguments. It's kind of an indirect harm. The harm from the poison is not immediate. It doesn't feel anything right away. And it's not as bad as actually cutting up an animal or actually punching an animal in the nose. This is not so bad. Therefore, the Shvus Yaakov was lenient. So that was the first major precedent on the question of medical experimentation. The Imre Shefer, Rav Kalatskin, is talking about what was which was the contemporary controversial issue, which was full-blown anatomical experiments on animals, cutting them up, vivisection, doing all kinds of unpleasant things to animals for the benefit of medical science, advancement of medical science, which could be beyond academic, which could be beneficial for humans, for the study of medicine, for human purposes. Is it okay? So Rav Kalatskin writes, Ein hadavar bar, not clear to me, he says, doesn't flat out say it's prohibited, but he leans toward prohibiting. He says, Ein hadavar bar, it's not clear to me, Shemutr l'tzar b'alchai b'tzar ayim kazeh, that it should be permitted to inflict such great, terrible pain on a living creature, just for l'tzar p'chinos v'nisyanos, for the purpose of tests and experiments. Lo matin r'shut r'el l'tzar k'refuah. As we've been mentioning, even Rav Kalatskin, who says that profit is not enough of a reason to torture an animal, refuah is. The Rambam says for refuah it is a good enough reason. Rav Kolatkin tries to distinguish. He says that's refuah. Refuah means actual medical benefit. You need some tissue to graft onto a person. You need some substance produced by an animal to actually use it directly for refuah. You can do, but not for experiments, not for testing. Lolitzar pachina. Shane William Suffolk. Why? Because it's only a Suffolk. Maybe, perhaps, sometime, we know how medical testing works. They test thousands of drugs, of which only a few of them ever come to practical use. Ulai is type, is that Tavala's Puffins or Rafua? Maybe what you're doing will somehow be beneficial. It's kind of a little paradoxical because, yes, it's true. You can say that any individual compound you're testing, it's quite likely it will not work. On the other hand, it's statistically extremely likely that the entire program of testing throughout the industry will yield some number of useful drugs. So any given experiment might not, but if you actually ban experimentation wholesale, then you're almost certainly going to not have some drugs, which you ordinarily would have. So I don't know how he deals with that. But he says, nevertheless, experimentation is a matter of suffix, he says. And then, in a remarkably broad and eclectic type of approach, he says, it's not just me with my Jewish conscience, he says, who objects to this. There are some scholars of the nation, they complain and they bitterly oppose the cruel type of action that investigators, that scientists are doing on the animals, in their experiments on the bodies of living creatures, they establish societies. And that long word over there is anti-vivisectionistin. Societies of the anti-vivisectionists, there's still some around today. Societies whose purpose is to oppose vivisection, to oppose the dissecting, the cutting up of animals while they're alive. This is something that I always find particularly interesting, the question of, today when we talk about the American court system, the question of foreign law. Conservatives are always very opposed to judges who look to European law to try to import the ideas of the rest of the world, impose them on Americans. We want our own American law. And halacha, I always find this particularly interesting when poskim are willing to look to foreign law, essentially, to the ethics and the legal regimes of our host cultures, of contemporary society, as for guidelines as to what's mutter or what's not. There was a very sharp dispute in the mid-20th century between Rav Moshe Feinstein and many other poskim, particularly Hasidic poskim, about assisted reproductive technologies, in vitro fertilization or artificial insemination. I don't know all the details of what they were arguing about, but the Catholics have always opposed this type of stuff. They've always been very opposed to tampering with reproduction. So Rav Moshe had a famous ruling where he allowed a certain type of reproductive technology. I think it was donor IVF, was performing in vitro fertilization for a married woman with a donor sperm. And many poskim were strongly opposed, Hasidic poskim in particular. So Rav Reish, the Chelkas Yaakov, who we're going to get to in our topic soon, Rav Reish wrote a scathing critique of Rav Moshe's ruling. And one of his many lines of argument why we have to prohibit this, he says, is that the Catholic Church thinks this is an abomination, a moral abomination. So how can we be less frum than the Pope? So Rav Moshe wrote back, I don't understand. We're Jews. We have the Torah. We have our own system of ethics. Why do we care what they do? That's kuchuk sagayim. We have our own rules, and they think it's bad. We have our own opinions. So Rav Reish argued. No, Rav Reish tried to find precedents within halacha that we do have to be influenced by the moral opinions of the non-Jews. Rav Moshe disagreed. One of Rav Reish's main precedents is a ruling of the Magen Avraham. The Magen Avraham was talking about Amir Lakum on Shabbos, having a non-Jew do work for you on Shabbos. So one of the very detailed, complicated sugya, one of the particular cases discussed by the poskim involves kablanas, contracting type of work, where a non-Jew is performing some construction work for you on Shabbos. So there are certain cases where some of the poskim would allow it. So without getting into the details, the Magen Avraham brings the opinion that it's mutter. He says, however, even if it's mutter in principle, here today in modern Europe, he says, we can't do this because it would be a chil Hashem, because the non-Jews, when they have their days of rest, they would not do work via a non-Christians. They would not do Amir Yisrael, have a Jew work for them on their Sunday or their holiday or whatever. They would treat that as chil Shabbos. So if we work via non-Jews on Shabbos, even if it's technically mutter, they see that as hypocrisy and chilul Hashem, and you can't do that. So Rabbi says, so you see, if the non-Jews have a moral opinion, we have to respect it. And Moshe said, no, there the problem is they see us as being hypocrites. That they say, oh, you Jews, you're so frum, you don't, you think you pretend you keep Shabbos, then you find legalistic loopholes with the thumb to find ways to do it. But their moral opinions on their own, we don't care about. I never fully understood Moshe's distinction, because when it comes to Erva, it's the same thing. If they think this is Gilei Arayos, and we Jews were supposed to be frum, and Tanua, and we have Gilei Arayos, I don't know why Moshe thinks the Chil Shabbos case is so much different from the Gilei Arayos case. But in any event, this is something that comes up here and there across Halacha. The question of should we look to the non-Jewish mores, non-Jewish ethical opinions to formulate our Halacha. Another example I find interesting is burial and cremation. This was a great debate in the 19th century when the Reform Movement, for those who wanted to imitate the Christians, so they would start doing cremation and other non-traditional Jewish burial practices. The Orthodox Jewry pretty much universally was vehemently opposed to it. So in one tshuva, the Posek writes that the non-Jews themselves, generally traditional society considers it unethical, inappropriate to not bury, to cremate, so we should have to defer to their sensibilities, as if, again, we do derive morality from their ideas. But practically in the same breath, a line earlier in the tshuva, he wrote, who cremates? The ancient Romans cremated, the pagans cremated, and that was chukas hagoyim, to copy them. So on the one hand, when they do cremate, we say it's chukas hagoyim if we cremate. On the other hand, when modern Christians think it's not appropriate, then we say, oh, we have to respect their moral opinions. That just kind of illustrates the difficulty of when something is just, let's be inspired from the moral uprightness of our non-Jewish colleagues, and when we say adrabah chukas hagoyim. Rav Kolatkin in this case has no problem saying that he is, he approvingly notes the societies of the anti-vivisectionists and says that he thinks halacha would have a similar view. And then he goes on, he says, Kfarnasu v'nasnu b'sheila azos. This was actually debated, he says, this question, Basifas ha-kangresh al-jidoli chachmei ha-rofim b'london b'shnas tafresh ma'alaf. This is apparently something called the International Medical Congress of 1881. You can still get actual speeches. They're available at the J Store and so on. And one of the speeches, which he quotes, he says he read the speech. He says, Karasi Tochen Devrehem. I read the proceedings of the society in Michtav Eis HaAngli Times, in the English periodical, The Times, Miyom Hey August, Botzah Shavuos, the Sunday Times, apparently, in August 5th of that year, I guess, 1881. You can still find the article he quotes. You can still find it online. He, Professor Virchow in Berlin. This is Professor Rudolf Virchow, a leading pathologist and physician of the 19th century. He spoke at this Congress, Nosemi Dabrosa of the Kala Seifa. He defended vivisection. He defended the mainstream medical establishment. You should not consider it cruel. As long as a person has the right to kill animals, to eat, as long as we're not committed to vegetarianism, as long as we believe that people are above animals, he has the right to do whatever he needs to, including medical experiments. And he says that the only way for medical science to advance, he says, only through the benefit of these experiments, Titzad Chochmas HaRafua VaPhysiologia, so shall the science of medicine and physiology march forward, take great steps, Tzade Anak Mimeinuela, take giant steps in our days. 19th century certainly was a time of great advances in science. And can we really burden the doctors, he says, that they're risking their lives with treating contagious patients, he says, that they're anyway prepared to suffer from providing care to choli machlos mistabkos. You want to make them test medicines on themselves, too. It's not enough to treat the contagious patients. You want to make them. So some of the vaccine developers famously did. It was Jenner, I think, who at one point injected himself just to show everyone that it worked. Some of them did, but in general, he said, it's not fair. We can't really ask of the medical researchers to test only on themselves and not to test on animals. So go read this in the Times, he says, Ayin Shah Mukhtafayis Times. You'll see about this. Despite the fact, he says, that Virchow defended this and argued that this is the traditional view that humans have the right to do with animals as necessary for their benefit. Nevertheless, he says, this is controversial, even in modern Western society. And he said in the third paragraph, he says, B'chol zos, despite his defense, lo nuchel ha-hachlet, he's still not convinced that we can conclude Al pichuki tar senu akdosha that her reshus asunu l'rofa Yisrael. I'm not convinced that the Torah allows a Jewish doctor to engage in such practices. Begufei abal chai. He says, good, shchita you can do. Fine. Virchow says, you can do shchita, you can do medical experiments. Shchita, he says, is just for a moment. It's relatively painless. He's going to discuss that at greater length in the next few paragraphs. But the vivisection, he says, animal's alive and you're doing terrible things to it. And then he brings the Shmos Yaakov and he says that he's not convinced and he doesn't really paskin yes or no, but he is strongly inclined to the view that halacha would not allow these kind of excessively painful experiments on animals. Now, it should be understood, even though he's one of the first to discuss this question, he is something of an outlier. Throughout the 20th century, we have a number of other poskim who discuss this question of vivisection, of medical experimentation in general. There's a pretty strong consensus that it is actually mutter. This position, the leading position is adopted by the Tzitz Eliezer of Waldenberg, by Rav Reich, the Chalkas Yaakov, by Rav Chil Yaakov Weinberg and the Sri Deish. They all take the basic view of Virchow. They all say that that even though it's unfortunate, it's unpleasant for the animal, nevertheless, human benefit outweighs that. The Torah lets you kill animals. The animals are here are given to us for our benefit. And they all say, more or less, that it actually is permitted to do experiments on animals. Rav Waldenberg and Tzitz Eliezer actually recommends doing what you can to minimize the pain. He says, if you can use anesthesia in any given experiment, if you can use anesthesia, he says he would recommend it. Particularly, he says, he thinks it'll probably be more conducive to a successful experiment, so that the animal shouldn't be flailing and writhing. Depends, I guess, what experiment. There are probably some things that you need to test without being anesthetized and some that you don't. But in general, he says, if you can use anesthesia, you should. But Mikra Din, he seems inclined to the view that even without anesthesia, it's mutter. And that's probably the consensus view, I think, of most of the later poskim, that it would be mutter, not like Rav Galatkin's position. At the end of the day, Rav Galatkin fails, again, as we said, that ultimately many poskim intuitively take this attitude. You have to weigh the level of pain and suffering of the animal and the benefit to humans, and the likelihood of benefit to humans, in Rav Galatkin's opinion, at least in the medicine of the 19th century, maybe you can argue today medicine has advanced to the point where we're much more, we know we're doing a little bit more, maybe it's better. I'll call upon him, he himself, he saw the pain of the animal so vividly, he was not willing to countenance, he wasn't sure at least, that you can really allow doing such things to animals, even for the great benefit of the advancement of medical science, while the other poskim generally do allow it. It is interesting, though, that even within the general school of the Mechilim, of the later poskim who are lenient, we find an interesting dispute between Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg on the one hand and Rabbi Yaakov Breisch on the other. Rabbi Yaakov Breisch was in Switzerland, he's the one I mentioned before, who was so opposed to Ramosha's positions on reproductive technology. But Rabbi Breisch basically analyzes and understands medical experimentation through the lens of the Truma Sedeshin, which is, as I said, the paradigm ruling for this topic. He said, Truma Sedeshin says, anything for human need is mutter, even if it inflicts pain on animals. However, if there's a lot of pain involved, then it's achzarias, and people, even though it's mutter mikra din, it's good to avoid it. So Rabbi Breisch says, that's the way I look at medical experimentation. It's mutter, it's for a good cause, it's permitted. However, it's achzarias, and someone who has a refined moral sensibility will want to avoid it. Rav Weinberg is not happy with that position. He says, you yourself want to have a chumrah. You want to avoid pulling out feathers out of a chicken because it hurts the poor chicken. Even if you need the feathers, you'll forgo your down coat. You won't take the goose's feathers. You'll wear a wool coat or something else. Fine, your business. You'll have limited downside. There's not that much suffering. It's your personal decision. You want to be from Kodesh Yomerlo, great. You're from. He says, you're a scientist. The human society needs you. We need you to develop new medicines. We need you to develop new therapies. If the scientists as a whole are going to say, we are going to be frum, and we're going to be medactic, and we're going to stop doing medical experiments on animals, and as a result, the entire progress of medical science is retarded or stopped, brought to a halt, he says, the whole world is suffering because of you. First of all, the negative is much greater than in the case of the Truma Sedeshin. Second, you have a responsibility to all of humanity, not just your personal affairs. So he says, you have no right to say, I want to be frum, when your being frum means that medical science is going to suffer. Obviously, if you're just doing it for your career, or you're just doing it to develop some cosmetic or some or some industrial product to help people make money, then fine, then maybe not. But certainly if you're engaged in serious, important medical research and there's reason to believe that if you and everyone else who does what you do stops doing it, then medical science will suffer, which means medical science is an abstraction. It means human beings will suffer. Human beings who otherwise might be cured or have their pain alleviated, that's not going to happen because you're being frum. Rev Weinberg says that is the wrong thing to do, that you have an obligation. The right thing to do is to hurt the animals, since at the end of the day, humans are more important. Now, Rav Kotzkin goes on. He mentioned in the last paragraph, he said that those who wanted to say you could shecht an animal, why can't you do experiments on him? Rav Kotzkin said, no shaykhus. He says shechting an animal is humane, the pain is brief, and so on. And now he segues into a general discussion of his belief in the humanity of Shechita. He says, now he refers to a great controversy that began in the 19th century, maybe earlier, but exploded in the 19th century, the great controversies over Shechita. We still have them today in some European countries. Animal rights activists argue that Shechita, and some of them argue that halal methods of slaughtering animals are inhumane. And some European jurisdictions have actually banned Shechita. Back in the 19th century, there were some places in Switzerland that had banned Shechita.
We were just in Switzerland very recently, and it's banned in, I don't know, I think in all of Switzerland.
Right, so I was looking briefly at the history. So in the 19th century, there were some of the cantons had banned it, the federal government had considered banning it, and so Switzerland was one of the countries at the vanguard of this movement, was and still is apparently at the forefront of the anti-Shechita movement. Rav Kolatskin now addresses this. He says,
the Jews are happy that it's banned. We have a friend. He was stationed here in the embassy for a year. Now he's back in Switzerland. He's one of the leaders, Jewish leaders of the council, talks to government. He's part of the government himself. And he said they are allowed to import. Had the Jews been permitted to get a an exception for his Shechita because of the Muslims, who would like to do that also. The problem is the government would then not have let them import it, and they would depend only on their own Shechita, and then with their limited market, so the cost of meat would have gone through the roof. So they're much happier living with this.
All right.
Ostensibly, so whatever.
That's a win-win then. Okay, with the lesser of two evils or something. But yes. So Rav Kolatskin is addressing some of the two centuries earlier, the battles over Shechita in Switzerland. Eze Shanim, last 2 years, he says, Anshe Chevra Magini Balechayim. Before we talked about this, the Chevra's anti-vivisectionist, and now we're talking about society of those who protect living creatures. He has a couple of foreign words here I haven't quite been able to decipher. Tier Schutz, Parayan, I don't know what that is, but the context means they're humane societies of some type. They began to agitate about Shechita, to investigate, and to...
It's a Varein.
Varein is...
Varein is a band.
Oh, okay, so Varein is a... That's good, okay.
I'm not sure what the first one is.
Okay, so it's a band of some sort, an organization of some sort. Ubeize Mechozes Medina Schweiz, in some cantons and some regions of Switzerland, Matzu Ha-Anti-Semitism. For the rest of this paragraph, Rav Kolatskin is going to argue, and this has been a common retort to the Jews, that the ostensible concern for animal welfare is really a thin veneer over a deep-seated anti-Semitism. He said they're trying to ban Shechita, and they're requiring that animals be slaughtered. Now he used another few words. I don't know what they mean. What he's referring to, apparently, is the European mandate to stun the animals before Shechita. I don't know. The words he uses are Butarel, Shismaska, Machona Electris. Machona Electris is some kind of electrical form of stunning. The other two words, Butarel and Shismaska, I haven't been able to decipher. Apparently, stunning used to be done one of two ways, either through electrical stunning or through some kind of bolt or impact to the head, using a hammer or a captive bolt they use sometimes, whatever it is, different types of impact stunning to the animal. So the anti-Semites wanted to ban traditional Shechita and require stunning at least, or even killing it through a lie. I'm not sure if he's talking about stunning or actually killing it through these means. Now, Rav Kolaskin gets very bitter. He says he rages against what he considers the hypocrisy of the anti-Semites. He says, they're so concerned about animal welfare. He says, they go hunting. He says, they have their dogs. They hunt down animals. That is no problem. That they think is fine European culture, he says. La'oneg v'shashua nafsham, for fun and for pleasure. That they have no problem doing. But all of a sudden, when it comes to Shechita, Yehoftal, Regek, Rachmanim, all of a sudden, they're so concerned about poor animals, he says. He goes on this bitter, sarcastic vein for a while. Tachas masveh chemla v'arachemim, under a veil of compassion and mercy. They're trying to make life miserable. Revavas anashim, for tens of thousands of people, of Jews, take away their food because they're so humane and so concerned about the poor animals. L'hachris ochel v'piachenu b'nei Yisrael. And he says, well, Yasimu Lev, they're not acknowledging, they're not paying attention, L'mofsiach Chachma, to that which has been demonstrated through medical science. Asher Heru Ladas, Gedolia, Professorin, that the great professors, the great medical scientists have clearly demonstrated, Kiyashchita Nala Vatova. If Kolaskin makes a point, which is widely made by apologists for Shechita, I haven't really researched it, I don't know the science. I was reading briefly what people say about it today. Nobody really knows, it seems. But Shechita itself, they say, Rav Kolaskin and the defenders of Shechita argue, is extremely humane, is the best and most humane way of slaughtering animals. Mikolo fane atvicha misa acherim, from all other forms of killing animals. Ubak futsas devrem machberes a Dr. Ehrman mitrier. The collection of their papers, their arguments, are found in some volume published by a Dr. Ehrman. Asher nikra b'shem, again that word, tiar shutz, unmention trutz. Mention our people, I don't know what the other words are. Huvadvar of Michtaf Ha'ez Yiddish Press. This is brought in the periodical Jewish Press, some early Jewish press, 18th April in 1885. So, again, I don't know the details. Apparently today, a lot of the arguments in the U.S. deal more with preparing the animal for Shechita, the hoist and shackle method, where they gank the animal up with chains and hold it upside down. Shechita itself, there's this Temple Grandin. Dr. Temple Grandin was apparently an expert on humaneness in animals, and she's willing to work with industry to not just oppose them, but to work to improve the practices. She apparently makes this point that the thing we should focus on, the knife itself, is probably not the worst part of the process. It's more the way they manhandle them and terrorize them, set them up for the Shechita. So she has ways of trying to alter the procedures, and she's worked with Schlachteis apparently to work with the procedures to make it more, you know, less traumatic for the animal in general, and that's and so on. But anyway, the Rav Kolaskin here is making what's, I think, a traditional classic defense of Shechita, that it is actually extremely humane. Now he goes on, one last fascinating paragraph. Kvarher b'tzed the kachacha maharim rabinowitz. I'm not sure who this is, but he approves of the point made by this Rabbi Rabinowitz in a book called Yisod Yashchita. She'ena pirchus u'tnua shel behema achar shchitasa. That the flailing and the twitching of animals after Shechita, apparently many people argued that Shechita is so terrible, the animal looks like it's still alive and still suffering after you cut its throat, it's still exhibiting signs of life, it must be in great pain, and so on. Says Rav Kolaskin, says this Rabbi Rabinowitz, none of those signs of motion have anything to do with real life or sensation as we know it. None of that indicates they actually feel any pain. As proof, he says, Kasher gam achar krisas kol harosh mechunas hagiyatin, after the head has been severed, the person's been decapitated with a guillotine, nirabala pa'amim krisas einayim, the head sometimes winks, and the eyes still move, even after. Clearly, everyone's going to agree, when the head has been removed, the spinal cord has been cut, clearly he's not feeling pain anymore, the assumption is. So you see that these types of muscular twitches, muscular movements, are not indication of life and sensation. And then Rav Kolaskin adds, in an even more fascinating point, Hachokrim Bachanu, scientists, investigators, again, have tested Bagisham Guf Adam Tolei Litzire Amud Hagalvani. They attached a person who had been hanged to the terminals of some kind of galvanic apparatus, some kind of battery or electrical apparatus, for Rosh, a pirpir, but nuos muzaris. And they saw that the cadaver began to flail in a bizarre ways. On November 4th, 1818, Scottish chemist Andrew Ure, U-R-E, stood next to the lifeless corpse of an executed murderer, the man hanging by his neck at the gallows only minutes before. He was performing an anatomical research demonstration for a theater filled with curious students, anatomists, and doctors at the University of Glasgow. Ure held two metallic rods charged by a 270-plate voltaic battery to various nerves and watched in delight as the body convulsed, writhed, and shuddered in a grotesque dance of death. And so on. Apparently, many scientists were experimenting with applying electricity to a cadaver and seeing what would happen. Ure himself was a bit of had some rather curious ideas. He thought you could actually bring people back to life by applying enough electricity or applying electricity the right way. Other scientists just wanted to see how the body interacted with electricity. This is where Rav Kolaskin is quoting. Again, he was apparently a fairly well-read 19th century rabbi. He was familiar with these bizarre, macabre experiments where they took a hangman and attached him to a battery of some sort and watched how he would spasm and writhe. And Rav Kolaskin's point, his point, he's not interested in bringing the guy back to life, his point is, you see, the guy is clearly dead. Nevertheless, the fact that he's twitching and moving can happen. So too the cows, he claims, once the throat has been cut, we can assume the animal is dead and insensate, and the fact that he's moving doesn't matter. I don't actually know modern anatomy whether we would agree with this conclusion, that the cows are actually dead instantaneously when the throat is cut. I think I've read that when blood doesn't get to the brain, it dies pretty quickly like that. I don't actually know, but I'll call upon him. This is Rav Kolaskin's point. So on the one hand, he's very much against medical experimentation on animals. He feels that that is not absolutely forbidden. Doesn't absolutely forbid it, but he feels it is just too cruel and just the benefits are too uncertain, and even for human benefit, he's not willing to permit it. He sides with the anti-vivisectionists. On the other hand, when it comes to Shechita, even though there are also humane societies who are against, that he feels is misguided. He doesn't agree in principle that it would be right to oppose something which inflicted great pain on animals necessarily, but he says, on the contrary, Shechita is an extremely humane form of animal slaughter. Those who are opposed to it are rooted in hypocrisy, see the fact they hunt, ignorant, they don't understand that the animal's really dead, even though it's twitching. And in general, he says, on the contrary, he simply has a disagreement about the facts. He says that Shechita is a remarkably humane method of slaughter and does not constitute Tzar Balei Chaim.